Accession number 8668, row number 3.
Mrs. Mogridge, Rail 3. You were saying about your first ferry flight to Scotland.
Yes, well, actually, now I come to think of it, I think it was one of them. It was the first 3 or 4 days that I was joined. I think I did a very short one first, you know. And then after that, it was a long navigational flight to Scotland, which took a couple of days, because the aeroplanes only flew at about 80 miles an hour or 70 miles an hour, very slowly. And it was icy cold in winter time. No, it wasn't. It was August. But it still was icy cold because they were open aircraft. And there were 5 of us going up north, and I was told I had to be the 5th one, and I had to really watch where the 5th one was going and do whatever she did. So, but I wasn't to get too close because I hadn't learnt to formate. So we took off, and we landed. Our first landing was sort of within 2 hours, which our petrol would have run out. We only had 2 hours flying each time, so we landed and refueled. I think it was Turn Hill, if I remember. Then we took off again, and we landed at another place 2 hours later. It used to take 8 hours to get up there. So then we'd land. Then we stayed the night, and the next day, weather wasn't very good, so we took off rather late in the afternoon, and we had about 6 hours to do 4 hours in, so before daylight, we lost daylight hours. However, we got into our straps and helmets and things and opened air aircraft, no map of course, I don't know what would happen if I'd lost them in cloud or anything, and we took off, and I was the 5th one to go each time, and there were a gaggle of 5. When we got to Carlisle, which is in Cumberland, and it's the last stop before we went to Prestwick, which is in Scotland. And it was very misty now because it was getting late afternoon. And the clouds seemed to be coming down and you could hardly see the airfield. However, I knew they'd all landed, so I came in last. And just as I was taxiing in, out of the mist I saw another 4 aeroplanes taxiing out again. And I'd undone all my straps. And I looked at my petrol tank and I thought, well, I hadn't got much petrol left. What are they doing? Perhaps they'd got lost and they'd landed to find out where they were. So I hurriedly strapped myself up as best I could and hastily took off to follow the 5th one, the 4th one. And we took off and we followed. It was so bad we had to follow the railway and the road and the river, which goes from Carlisle or Dumfries and then on to Prestwick, in amongst the hills. So we had these hills on either side, absolutely nowhere to land, and my petrol was registering pretty nearly empty, and I thought, I don't know where we're going. I wonder why they took off again. I can't understand it. However, as soon as I saw Prestwick, which I'd never seen before, but I saw a runway, I just landed, and I never worried about the others. The others came in and landed after me, and I got out, relieved, and I told the chap for the petrol, the fuel, that I didn't think I had any petrol left at all, which verified later I had about 1.5 gallons, which had lasted a few minutes. However, the other 4 people got out of their aeroplanes, and there were 4 entirely different girls that I'd followed. This time they weren't the ones I'd originally started with. And they said, what are you doing here, Jackie? How did you get here? And I said, well, I was following Rosemary Rees and all that lot. So they said, oh, but they landed at
Carlisle.
And I said, yes, but, oh, well, where did you come from? They said, we just took off at Carlisle. We'd been stuck there for a week in bad weather. And we just took off hoping that we could just manage to get to Prestwick for this last, before the daylight, you know. We lost the hour of daylight. So I said, oh, Lord. And funnily enough, I'd got there and went home with the other 4. And, of course, the other people were stuck at Carlisle for about another 3 or 4 days. It wasn't that extraordinary.
How did you get home from these long trips?
We used to take the night sleeper from Glasgow. And then we were lucky if you got a sleeper, but anyway, we'd travel down always by sleeper or by a night train, and then the next morning we'd start work again, go and do another trip up somewhere.
What exactly were your duties? Could you?
We were taking aeroplanes
from the factories to the aerodromes and to the operational units, and also taking them from the operational units when they weren't in very good condition back to get things put on them or mended or fixed or maintained back to the, or the radios altered or something, back to the maintenance units. And then we would also take them to the what we call the MUs, which are the maintenance units, which they used to put them, they used to store them away in fields and things so they couldn't be bombed, you know, those that weren't being used. So we'd take them first of all from the factory, perhaps to a maintenance unit. There they would be kept until they were needed by a squadron. Then we would go to the maintenance unit and take them to an operational squadron, and then be picked up at an operational squadron, either ferry one of the old ones back or be picked up by what we called a taxi aircraft, which went around picking the pilots up and took them back to base. I was about a year at Hatfield, and I was five years at... I was right from one end of the war to the last, so, and after the war, so that was about 6 years I did, I think.
And where did you move to from Hatfield?
From Hatfield we went to Hamble, which is Southampton, and we were nearly all bombed out. You know, we were billeted in all over the place. People weren't too happy about it, but they had to have us. And then they tried to get us near enough to the airfield so that we could either just cycle or walk to the airfield.
What were your hours of duty?
Well, you reported in the morning. It depends, you know, how early. If the weather was good, they liked you to be early. And then you'd get your job, and then you'd set off as quickly as you possibly could, because we could only fly in daylight, because we had to see the ground, we had to map read, we didn't have any navigational aids. And although some of the aircraft were fitted with radar at that time, later on in the war, they were all covered up and were secret, and nobody was to know about it, so we wouldn't be allowed to use it. We had no radio, we weren't allowed to use it if we had it. And we would just have to rely entirely on our being able to see the ground and to navigate with a map.
How confident were you? Because you'd also not been flying for nearly a year.
That's right, yes. Well, not a bit confident. Very terrified, really. Absolutely. Of course, the most terrifying thing is that you had an aeroplane to collect which you'd never seen before. Now, remember, I had only flown single-engine Tiger Moths, and these little aeroplane Puss Moths and little Winkworth things, whatever they were, and, you know, these little aeroplanes which only cruise at about the topmost about 80 miles an hour. Well, gradually you were starting to do much faster things. For instance, I had to go, we were presenting the Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands with a Hawker Hart, I think it was, or Hawker Fury, one of the Hawker types, which just that time when I was in South Africa was the South African Air Force aeroplane, fighter aeroplane. And, you know, I was thrilled to bits to think I was going to fly something like that, which in my wildest dreams in South Africa I never thought I'd ever do. I used to go and watch when I went up the hill. And I had to take it to Prince Bernhard, to the airfield, and England was presenting it to him, because he was a pilot, you know. And he was staying here while the Germans had France, Holland, remember? And that sort of it. Well, that was an entirely different aeroplane. You see, it was a fighter. But I still had to go and fly it and just pull a few knobs here and there with this little notebook we had, which had every type of, every conceivable type of aeroplane in the Navy, the Air Force, the American Air Force, and commercial aeroplanes and transport aeroplanes, fighters, bombers, anything. We flew everything. Well, at least not all of us flew everything, but the ones that had a bit more experience. And we had a notebook the size of about 4 inches by about 3, and only a few inches deep. And that notebook, each page consisted of an aircraft and how to fly it the simplest way, and which knobs to pull and which not to pull. And those books were very, very... Well, if we lost those, we couldn't fly the aeroplanes, because everyone was different, entirely different. And we also had a piece of paper which said that we had the authority to fly any aircraft that was stated on that book. Because once I went to pick up a mosquito from a station, and the engineering officer flatly refused to. He wasn't having any schoolgirl flying his aeroplane that he'd worked so hard on, thank you very much. And he just wouldn't let me have it. So I showed him my authorization card, and even that wasn't enough. He went and rang everybody up, from the Air Ministry down to, you know, to the station commander. Of course, he had to give it to me in the end, but he'd been abroad and he didn't realise that they had women doing this sort of job. So he was very reluctant to let me have his wonderful mosquito. He'd spent weeks, you know, putting right. That's the sort of thing we had to contend with, you see. And you went to pick up an aeroplane that you'd never seen before, and you... Well, as far as I was concerned, I didn't look at the outside. That was the engineers did that. I'd get in, and then I'd look at my little notebook, and anything I didn't understand, I'd ask one of the engineers to just say to me, you know, is I'm pulling the right thing. And, of course, once I pulled out a thing that looked like a funnel, and I said, what's this? As I was in a Spitfire, and this great tube with a funnel on it. And I said, what's this for? And he said, that's only for gentlemen pilots, miss.
I'd no idea. Did it worry you, having to fly a different aircraft all the time?
Well, we were told that there were certain types of pilots that made ferry pilots. Not all pilots could be a ferry pilot. And once or twice they had to throw people out because they just weren't capable of flying, say, a Hampden, which had a very, you know, coming to land with very high up the cabin, pilot's cabin. And another time you'd be flying something very low, like a tiger moth, you know, or an oyster. And some people were incapable of doing that sort of thing. And funnily enough, the natural pilots who weren't very technical like myself, I mean, I had to know all the technicalities, but I wasn't what you call an engineer, were much better at that sort of thing, because as I said before, it was you absorbed it, the element, and you weren't actually, you were flying, you weren't necessarily flying a type, if you know what I mean, so you absorbed it, and therefore you could fly more or less anything. You didn't have to think, sit in it for half an hour and say, well, I'm so many feet above when I'm landing. Well, I was lucky I happened to be one of those types, you see. But if I'd been the technical pilots, and usually they were engineers too, weren't very good at that because they have to analyse everything. And if you had to analyse it and worry about whether you're 2 feet above the ground when you land or 6 feet above the ground or 20 feet above the ground, well, you wouldn't have had time to be that sort of pilot, you know. You couldn't be that sort of pilot. Of course we worried. Went to pick up my first Spitfire from Oxford, Cowley. It was a little, it's now a car factory, but in those days it was a very small little field. And they were turning out Spitfires, and you had to sort of take off and get above all these factories in a very short distance. And now there's no way that they could give you instruction on a Spitfire. I mean, you just had to go and take it and hope for the best. And when I got there, they were running it up, and there were sparks and flames pouring out all sides, you know, because that's it, the exhaust and everything. A huge Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, you see. And I was absolutely petrified, and I thought, I'm never going to manage this. And I only had to take it to Bryce Norton, which wasn't very far away, which is the place I landed when I was lost. And, but, you know, I was absolutely petrified because it looked so vicious. It really did. While it was running up, it's not so vicious when you see it on its own. Anyway, I got in and followed all the notes and held my breath, and it flies like a tiger moth. If you can fly a tiger moth, you can fly a Spitfire. But of course it's fast, naturally. And it just goes like a bomb when you take off. And it's so powerful that the rudder pedal, which works the directional control, had to start off with your foot full out on the one side, the opposite side to which the propeller was rotating. Otherwise it would just do a right-angled turn, you know, before you took off.
Was that sort of thing written in your ferry pilot's notes?
Oh, well, yes, it was. That's the sort of thing we had to know because you'd have killed yourself. In fact, very few people killed themselves. The few people that did were flying in bad weather. One pilot was flying sort of between the Isle of Man and Liverpool, and funnily enough, he lived. He wasn't killed. No, this one wasn't killed. But a lot of them probably were in those circumstances. That's how we know, and they just disappeared without trace. And suddenly, it was raining, foggy, and he didn't know, and he kept looking at his altimeter. And if you're running into a low-pressure system, your altimeter will overread, so you think you're higher than you are. And suddenly, he found himself
under the sea, in water. He'd gone lower and lower. Well, you see, he couldn't see. Couldn't see anything. So he had the good sense to push his hood back and release everything and swim. He had a pack with him, you know, and he was picked up. But that was an absolute miracle, that was. A miracle escape, it really was. And he was a strong swimmer. And he'd been seen to go in by some fishermen, and they picked him up. He was just lucky. And lots of people were lost on those little bits of sea, you know, in fog and rain and stuff, when you didn't know when you were going to hit them. You didn't know where you were. And, you know, the Duke of Kent hit a hill, didn't he? The same circumstances. And he was killed in the war when he was 1942. And it's very difficult. I had to pick up somebody from Scotland and take them down to Warmwell. They were army officers. One was a major, and there was a captain, and then there was a lieutenant, and then there was a sergeant with them. Or one version of sergeant. I didn't know the army ranks. And we were flying this aeroplane. I was bringing them down. I had taken an aircraft up there, and I had to bring these people back in one I was ferrying, which happened to be an Anson, which was a sort of medium bomber, but we used it as ferrying, really, as a transport taxi thing. And it was just solid cloud, just solid cloud. So I had to sort of really pray that I'd get clear sometime, you know, but you needn't have, because that's what happened to Amy Johnson, you see. That's another story. Anyway, so, and they were getting very worried, because especially the little young lieutenant, he was getting very worried. And then the captain was sitting... The major was sitting in one of the seats at the back, and the window blew out, blew in, and just shattered the glass, you know, the window blew in. It wasn't very helpful. And they were getting really worried because, you see, to them, it's just like flying through thick fog, but it's cloud, of course. And when I knew that, more or less, when we got to the coast, it should be clear, so as soon as I thought I was sort of over the coast and I saw the clouds clearing, then I would descend. I wouldn't descend unless I could see more or less the ground, you know. It's very dangerous. And I brought them in safely, sort of followed the road, and that's how we had to do it. Sort of followed the coastline and said, well, that's Brighton, Worthing must be somewhere here, you know, and so on. And it was, that's, we lost about 30 women, actually, out of 130, which isn't bad. We lost a lot of men. I think there were about 400 men. I'm not absolutely sure. We did lose quite a lot of men. But when you really think that we flew aircraft on a notebook, and really difficult aircraft, fighters, bombers, things like that, we were also trained for twin engines. We had 2 hours with Joan Hughes, who used to instruct, and she would put us onto the twins, and for 2 hours we'd do some circuits and landings. And then after that, we flew all twins. You see, mosquitoes, the lot. We didn't have a special lesson on a mosquito. And one day I was coming from Scotland with a mosquito, and another girl coming in a mosquito, and she and I were formating on each other, and when we were bringing it down to Odium, you know, in the Sussex, and as we got near, we both entered a very heavy snowstorm, and there's quite a lot of hills and things there, so, you know, we didn't want to suddenly stick our nose down, because they're very fast and you go down very quickly. So we each had a young engineer girl with us. Actually, I think I had a man that day, engineer, because we were, I can't remember, oh, sometimes we used to take them with us for a ride, give them a change, you know, they were, and she had a girl engineer, very pretty young blonde who was an engineer, I think she was qualified too, young girl, and they were coming into land at Odeon, and I didn't actually see it happen, but when I came out of the snowstorm, found the airfield, came in and landed, but where I was landing, there was just a big black patch at the side of the runway. Something had burnt out, I could see that. Really, just a big black patch. And I couldn't see this other airplane anywhere. Anyway, I came in and landed, and afterwards I was told that she'd landed before me, and she didn't do a circuit or anything, you know. She thought, oh, runway, I'm coming in, and didn't sort of give herself time to think. And she came in, and just about 50 feet off the ground, they're very fast aeroplanes. Now, she wasn't very experienced like I was, and I think this was one of her, you know, she'd had many mosquitoes. And she had this young engineer girl with her, and they, whether she was letting the young engineer girl have a go, I don't know, but they got to 50 feet, and they stalled, Now, to land a mosquito, you had to come in at 120 miles an hour, which is a lot, very fast in those days. And they just stalled, and they hit the ground from about fifth, well, quite high, and it just exploded. And that was it. That was the black patch. There was nothing left in those few minutes.
What sort of
an engineer girl was killed as well. Well, I was terribly upset because I liked her very much. She was such an... And I thought that other little girl was so pretty, the little engineer girl. Broke my heart, you know, to think she was about my age. And I thought, oh, you know... I think we were about 21 at the time. I was, she was. It was towards the end of the war. And she was... Well, I just, you know, it just broke my heart to think that such a young life had gone like that.
What was the official attitude towards accidents?
Well, of course, if you lived, then you went before a court. Oh, yes, I went before a court. And then they decide whether it's your fault or their fault. You see, for instance, I had a Spitfire into East Lee near Southampton, and the balloons are up there. At least I was told that they only had to do one landing because nothing worked. The brakes didn't work, the flaps didn't work. Nothing worked.
Was this one of the aircraft that was to be
dismantled? Yes, that's right. So I was bringing it in, and suddenly they must have had an air raid because all the balloons went up, which meant even if I'd wanted to, I couldn't go around again. There was no way I could go around again. So actually, they didn't tell me that the flaps didn't work. They just said, be careful, you know, some things mightn't work. And, of course, the flaps didn't work. And the Spitfire is just like a bullet without flaps. I mean, it just comes in and... East Lee is a very... It was only one little field. That's all it is. With great gun things at the end where you land at the end of the runway. And, of course, to miss those gun things, I steered a bit and I went into the fence because I had no brakes and I had no... I either had to do that or I had to lift up the undercarriage, which would have done a lot of damage and ruined the aeroplane. So I thought, well, I'd only ruin the propeller, perhaps, if I go hit the head. You think of all these things, you know. So, anyway... And I could have hit that with all those soldiers in it, the gun place, you know. Not one of them came near me to get me out of it. Of course, I had to switch everything off, you know. And I got out and took my helmet off. And, of course, they were shattered, these boys, you know, to see me get out of this thing. They thought it nearly went into them. They were seeing it coming towards them at terrible speed. And at the last minute, I steered away, you know. And I had to go before a court to decide whether it was my fault. You see, well, why didn't I go round again, they said. You know, why didn't I go round again and make an even lower approach? I said, well, for one thing, I didn't know the flaps weren't going to work till the last minute, so I could have gone round again, but the balloons went up just as I was coming into land. So what do I do? Do I just keep going and hit something that's not going to be so dangerous as hit a cable of the balloon? You see? Of course, I was cleared, I mean, naturally. But that's the sort of thing, you see. And if you lived, you went before a court. One girl ferried, she was very arrogant, this girl. And she was a commercial pilot before the war. And she was one of the original eight. And because she was, she thought, you know, she was another one who didn't like women. And not let us, another one. And I didn't really have much to do with her, so it didn't affect me. But she decided that she didn't need a map. She knew the countryside, you know, those people and everything. Well, she got lost. So she landed in a field, and there was no way they could get that aeroplane out of that field because it was too small and it would have been too expensive, and she damaged it anyway, and so on and so on. So it was a write-off. So, of course, she was thrown out. She did it three times.
She landed three times?
Well, over. Three times she had accidents that were her fault, so they throw them out. You only had to have three, you see. I had three, but it wasn't my fault each time. Well, they know if it's your fault. I mean, they naturally do, because they have to go through valuable aeroplanes, you see. And you just couldn't take chances, no matter how good you thought you were. You had to jolly well make sure that you knew what you were doing, because it's a terrific responsibility.
Were you told this, to take care of the aeroplane?
No, funnily enough, they didn't. Only after you'd had an accident they told you, which was a bit late. But, you know, I suppose anyone with a bit of intelligence would think so. I was more terrified of having an accident than I was of killing myself, you know. I used to pray that if I had an accident, I'd rather kill myself, because I didn't want to damage an aeroplane.
You said there was a psychological attitude needed to ferry all these different planes.
Yes.
What about physical qualities? Did you need to be strong?
Well, they said you did, but quite honestly, it depended on the person. You see, if you were the type that had to use brute force to do anything, then you weren't any good at that job, because aeroplanes don't need brute force. What they need is a delicate touch, and you've got lots of things to help you. If you think you need brute force, then you have to use your trims. You've got three different trims that guide you in the three different directions. So you've got to know how to use them. And if you use those, then you could more or less fly anything after all. I only weighed 7 stone, you know, and I'm 5'3". And I had to have lots of boxes and cushions and everything to do it. But there are lots of women like that. In fact, there were lots of aeroplanes that my size weren't allowed to fly. But I did anyway, because very often there wasn't anyone else to do it. Some of the American things were built for 6-foot-plus people, and there were no way that you could alter the seats, you see. So what I used to do is I used to put my parachute, use that as a cushion, and then also get a great big cushion I'd carry around with me and shove it at the back, and all the log books and things, and put those as well. And very often I couldn't strap myself in as a result, because the straps wouldn't reach, you see, because I had to be so far forward to reach the rudder pedals. But that's how we did it, and then used the trim. And I ferried a lot of the aeroplanes that needed, that were supposed to be over 5'6" before you were allowed to ferry them.
Did people know, in authority, know you were flying these planes when you weren't meant to be?
No, I don't think so, because, you know, they brought these rules out, because by that time I had a lot of experience and I could overcome these jobs. I don't say I could have done it in the beginning when I, you know, just started. I wouldn't know what to do, because I just wouldn't have been able to reach. But afterwards, you know, you get so used to it that you think, oh, well, I can fly an aeroplane now. I just need, as long as I can reach everything, which is important.
Did it worry you that you had to have these
straps? No, never thought about it. No, never. I must admit that, funnily enough, having been a terrified child, it shows that anybody can do anything if they really want to. Having been the sort of person that nobody in their wildest dreams would have thought could have done it, and I did, it shows that anybody can do anything. Therefore, women can do just the same things as men can do. I don't say we do it the same, because we don't. We do it differently. I mean, many things that I know, when I go for my test, they used to say to me, you'll never get in, you'll never get in. No, you'll never get in. You're too high, you're too low, you're too something. And I used to say, no, I'm not. I know what I'm doing. But I did it a different way from the way they fly. See, women fly differently from men. And I used to get in perfectly. And they said, well, I swear blind you couldn't have done it. You know, afterwards they'd say to me. But you see, whether it's the fact that they think you can't do it, or whether it's the fact, I don't really, whether we're so different that we do things differently, the end result's the same.
And did they accept that you were going to do things differently?
No, they didn't, you see. That was the whole point. And they never did throughout my whole life. They never did. They always expected me to do things their way. When I was flying for a company called Imperial Tobacco, there were two pilots, and they always flew two captains so that they could fly all day.